Bokeh tov to everybody. Welcome to the new change of scenery, just for 1 week. Hopefully everybody's got a place and got a sheet, and we're able to continue nicely up here, and then hopefully next week we'll be back downstairs again. This year is the second part of a continuation of what we started last week. And I'd like to just recap on what we did last week, and so we can see where we're going with today's shiur. We're talking about the very difficult situation of Agunot, and what possible solutions there are and have been suggested to Agunot over the last 100 years. And we talked last week about the classical Aguna scenario, where the husband was missing, or where the husband was incapacitated. And then we talked about the modern Aguna scenario, where the husband is alive and well, but denying his wife the get that she is entitled to, and we talked about what can be done about that. The starting point last week really was the Mishnah that we read there, which said that the get has to be given willingly. The husband cannot be forced to give the get. If the husband is forced to give the get is not valid. And we looked there at a number of different scenarios, and we said as follows. If the bet din forces the husband to give the get, then that is valid. Why? We looked at the long Rambam, the famous Rambam that says that they're not really forcing him, really his inner ratzon wants to give the get, they're just releasing him from his yetzer hara, and therefore the bet din is beating him, if you like, until he says roitze ani. However, we said that if the bet din forced the get inappropriately, they was not halachically allowed to force the get, then even if the bet din do it, the get is invalid. And therefore the bet din can only force the get when the get can legally be forced, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then we looked about a non-Jewish court. We looked at a non-Jewish court and we said a non-Jewish court is never allowed to force a get. Under any circumstances, if the get is forced by a non-Jewish court, the get is invalid. Even if, halachically, you could have made a case that it was justifiable if it was done by a non-Jewish court, that does not count. The only exception, we said, is if the Beit Din has made a ruling and the non-Jewish court enforces that ruling, that works. That's okay. But it's very limited when you're dealing with a non-Jewish court. Please come in and take a seat, if there is a seat. There's a few chairs over here. I'm sure some gallant gentleman wouldn't mind. Yeah, that's right. A rush. So we saw last week that there are certain circumstances where the halacha says, kaifin, that you are allowed to force the get, and there the Beit Din has a certain amount of leeway. But there are many situations which the halacha doesn't say kofin, it just says, he should give a get. Yotiv Yifin Ksuba, he should give a get. And there we said there's a big debate, is the Beit Din allowed to force a get under those circumstances? It's not so straightforward. So, given that it's not always possible for the Beit Din to get involved and force a get, even with other measures that we said last week, even if it's not physically, although that's almost impractical these days, even if it's with social sanction or if it was putting people in cheirem, etc., etc., if there isn't a Beit Din option, so what other possibilities does the couple have? In order to avoid these problems before they even get going? So today, what I want to do is to finish off the topic, and then we'll move away from marriage issues. To next week, please God, we'll talk about something completely different, and we'll get into a whole new discussion. But just to finish with this today, let's talk about other potential possibilities. There's a lot of English on this sheet today. I apologize for that, or maybe not, depending on what you prefer. There's a lot of discussion on this. I've decided to try and give you lots of footnotes, lots of sources and links to other things that you can download and find in different places. But there are a few important sources on the sheet as well. But I want to take you through it so that you can see what I've put together to help here. Option number one, if coercion by the Beit Din doesn't work. So what about a civil action? Can the wife, who is being refused the get, can she sue the husband in the civil court and say, you are causing me emotional and psychological abuse, and therefore I'm going to sue you? And the answer is, of course she can, if she wants to. The problem with such suits is, if the husband is very rich, and damages are awarded against him, then he won't really care. If the husband is very poor, and damages awarded against him, then he equally won't care, because he won't help, because there's no point suing people who have no money. I used to be a lawyer, believe me, okay? There's no point suing. If you can sue insurance, that's the best. But if you have to sue people, you better sue people who have got some money to pay. So it might not do any good. And if, of course, the court decides that the husband is in contempt, and says to the husband, you're going to jail because you're in contempt, because you're not giving your wife a get, the minute the court does that, there's a good possibility that the get will be an invalid get, because basically the civil court is forcing the husband to give a get. So that's not helpful at all, and is unlikely to be much of a solution. What about going to the Beis Din and claiming that there is a emotional stress in the Beis Din? Maybe they'll be able to give an award. And there is a possibility, and I brought you a note at the bottom, that there's a very interesting article by Rabbi Yehuda Warburg about whether a wife can sue in the Beis Din for damages, for psychological, emotional stress. That may be possible as well. A more likely claim is the wife can claim damages for mezonot. She can say to him, look, you've left me, and now I have no money, and because I have no money, I'm suing you for the support that you should have given me. And that can be, if you like, an incentive for the husband to give the get, because all the time he doesn't give the get, it's costing the wife money. It's costing the husband money, excuse me. So can the wife sue the husband for mezonot? And the answer is, in theory, yes, he can. But it's a problem. Because halachically, he is only obligated to give her mezonot if he left her. If she left him, he halakhically has no obligation to keep paying for her. And who's going to say who left who? And of course, when you're suing for money, the principle in halacha is, hamotzi mechavero alav haraya. If you want to get money out of someone else, you've got to prove that they're the ones that's liable. So you're going to have a he said, she said, debate in the court, and it's not going to be so easy to do. So suing for mezonot in the court is not necessarily an option. Can people hear me okay? I've just got a lot of noise in my ears from the air conditioning, but if you can hear me, I'm happy. Fine. What other options are there? So I'm sure many of those who are from America, especially from New York, will be familiar with the get laws. There were a series, two really, get laws in America, which were brought in to try and deal with this issue. There was a law in 1983. What did the get law do in 1983? So the New York State get law in 83, said that whichever party filed for divorce has to remove all barriers to remarriage before the court will give them a civil divorce. That way, the court can turn around to the person who filed for the divorce and say, no, we're not going to give you a civil divorce because you have not removed all barriers to remarriage for your spouse. And if that meant the husband hadn't given the wife a get, so the court could say, okay, so we're not giving you a civil divorce because you never gave your wife a get. According to almost all the poskim in New York at the time, in America at the time, that was absolutely fine. Because it wasn't coercing the husband to give a get. He doesn't have to give a get. He just won't get his civil divorce. That's up to him. He has no right to a civil divorce. The court can decide whether he's entitled to a civil divorce. And therefore, the poskim said this was 100% kosher or yosher, and that works fine. The trouble is, it works fine in halacha, but it didn't work too fine in American law. Because only the person who actually filed for divorce ended up triggering this process, so the husband could basically delay and delay and delay and delay and never bother filing for divorce, and it would never be a problem. And also there were husbands that said, look, I don't care about a civil divorce, you know, I'll leave you and I'll go off and live with somebody else. And as that became more and more of a reality for people, this didn't really help people. So a lot of pressure was placed on the court to bring in a new law, and in 1992 there was a new law, a new get law in New York, which a lot of people lobbied for, which solved some of the legal problems, but it caused more halachic problems. What happened in New York? So the following. The new law in 1992 basically said that not only can the court withhold a civil divorce, but when working out the financial settlement of alimony and how much each one has to pay and who has custody, etc., they can take into account the fact that the husband isn't giving the wife a divorce. So now it starts to cost the husband money because he's not giving his wife a get. And it's the civil courts that are telling him, you've got to pay, you've got to pay, you've got to pay, because you're not giving your wife a get. And there already there was a very big brouhaha in the postgame. There was some postgame that said, no, if the payment was just financial support, if it was demei mezonot, then that's fine. But others said, no, this is a penalty telling the husband if he doesn't give a get, he's liable to this penalty. And if that is the case, then that indeed would be a get me'useh, because the civil court was basically fining the husband by awarding damages against him if he didn't give a get. And therefore, according to many poskim, this was a big question. There was a big debate in the American civil law system as to what was the correct interpretation of this get law. Was it indeed a financial penalty or not? And many poskim said it was completely invalid. and it could not be used halachically. In fact, there were some poskim, and there still are some poskim, that are so concerned about the New York get law that they raise the possibility that because this law exists, it could be that every single get given in the state of New York is invalid. Because every single husband is under some kind of legal threat. If the wife says, I'll see you in court, that already means that the get is somehow forced by the civil law procedure. Whoops, this damage is a danger to the system as well. That every get is potentially forced by the civil law procedure, and therefore maybe every get is invalid. That's an extreme position. Very few poskim hold that. But one thing is for sure, the 1992 law did not solve really the problem halachically, and therefore most poskim said there needs to be another solution. And this is really what I wanted to get into. Yes. The law, you mean the New York law?
No.
Which law do you want to change?
I
want to
change that a husband.
Okay, good, fine. So this is a bigger question, and I'm glad you asked this question. What does it take to change a law of that nature? So we talked a little bit about this before. Maybe I'll talk about this for 2 minutes. You have to work out what kind of category that kind of law change is in. Meaning there are different kinds of halachic change that require different kinds of mechanisms to change them. Let's say somebody wanted to turn around and say, I don't know, it says in the Torah that a husband gives his wife a get. I want it to be that the wife gives the husband a get. We're going directly against the psukim in the Torah. But that kind of change, to change the Torah itself, though, God needs to get us together with a new Har Sinai. We don't need to go to Sinai. We could go to Brooklyn, or we could go to, preferably let's do it in Yerushalayim. There needs to be a whole new revelationary find. So that's pretty much off the cards as far as we're aware. If somebody wants to change a halachic principle which is rooted in the Gemara, which clearly this one is, that if the get is forced, then it is invalid. This is a drosha made directly from the psukim and by Chazal, and it's unequivocal. Everybody agrees on the principle that the get has to be given willingly. If you want to change that kind of level of halacha, you need to basically unpick the Talmud and remake it. Now, we can do that, but only when we have a Sanhedrin. And this is a very important point. And we can have a Sanhedrin. We could have a Sanhedrin next week if we wanted. We don't need Mashiach for a Sanhedrin. We don't need there to be Olam Haba for a Sanhedrin. All we need for a Sanhedrin, says the Rambam, is if the majority of the rabbis in Israel would get together and agree with each other. So don't need a miracle. You don't need a miracle. If the Rambam Paskins, if the majority of Rabbanim in Eretz Israel were to get together and agree on a new Sanhedrin, then there can be a new Sanhedrin. And by the way, there were many attempts made to do this over the last centuries. There was an attempt to do this in Tzfat in the 16th century, which failed because of the politics. The Rabbanim of Tzfat got together and agreed, but the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim said, well, you didn't get us on board. You can't just do this unilaterally. You need to bring us into this project in order for it to succeed, and the project failed. There were a few people given smicha, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, and the Rabbi Yosef Karo, and the Al-Sheikh, etc., but it didn't succeed. There were other attempts. There were many people who felt when the state of Israel was created in 1948, this was a perfect opportunity to create a new Sanhedrin. And maybe it was, but it didn't happen. So one of the things to get frustrated about on Tisha B'Av, we're davening for things to change, is not just the Beit HaMikdash and the other things that we talk about in Sinat Chinam, etc., but it's also this halachic, if you like, what's the word? Not paralysis, because there is a lot that we can do, but there is a halachic limitation by the fact that we just don't have the bodies of law that the Torah wanted us to have in order to do this. So let's get a Sanhedrin and let's deal with it. I agree with you 100%. A new Sanhedrin could solve the Agunah problem tomorrow morning. It could. I don't think anyone disagrees on that. We just have to work out who's going to be on the Sanhedrin and how they're going to work it. There is a group of people today that call themselves the Sanhedrin. They're a nice, fine group of Talmidei Chachamim. They even have a website. It's very good. I recommend it. But the reason they're not the Sanhedrin is because they're not Mekubal by the Kal as a whole. It has to be a process of the top and the bottom coming together. So that's the answer to your question. Now, not everything needs a Sanhedrin to change, don't get me wrong. I can't give the whole shiur now, but there are other areas of halachic change which are not going against the Talmud, but maybe want to follow minority opinions within the Talmud, or just minority opinions within the halachic process. That doesn't need a Sanhedrin, and there we can appeal to the senior poskim of the generation to try and move the direction of halakha. That's a long process, which I'm not getting into now, how that works and what we can and can't do. Yes? Yes. By the basin. Yes. Yes, by the basin. Okay. Fine. So that is a nice solution, but it's not on the cards for this week. Yes. Dabble for it more. Yes. sorry, I can't hear you.
These two New York State laws.
Right.
Written by Rabbi Judah.
Okay.
And he has this patently contact with him, to accept him. The two Rabbanim that you cited in the chat are Israeli.
Correct, absolutely, Rav Eliyashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman, 100%. And there are many articles were written, including by American Rabbonim. You can look through the pages of Tradition Magazine, Tradition Journal, and also the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. Many articles were written by many Rabbonim, including American Rabbonim. Rav Gedalia Schwartz has written on this. Other people have written on this. And there is a debate on this. Some people say, absolutely, this get law is 100% satisfactory in order to solve the problem. But many people do not. And as long as many people do not, it's not going to be a solution that really works, because you can't have gittin accepted by this group but not this group. You end up with a very messy situation with a lot of people. That's not entirely true, and I'd like to move on to other solutions which have been much more accepted by the Israeli rabbinate, which we'll get onto in a minute, which is really the question we need to deal with now, which is the prenuptial agreement. And the reason that my mind is in this, because as you know, my daughter got married a couple of weeks ago, and the whole issue of prenuptial agreements came up, and are we going to do it, and are we not going to do it, and does this rabbi agree, and does this rabbi agree, and I'll tell you a lot later what we actually did about it. But the concept of prenuptial agreements is not a new one. The Gemara itself, the Yerushalmi, actually has a source that deals with prenuptial agreements directly. Have a look at source number one. Source number one is a Yerushalmi in Ketubos, which says the following. Amalun Rebbe Mana. So this is a Rebbe Mana, came along and said to the people who were gathered there in this marital dispute, we're on page two, source number one. Aysen Parna. Nikrena, bring the ksuba, he says, and let's read it. Let's see what's written in the ksuba, and we'll work out what to do with this couple. So, Aitum Parna, they brought out the ksuba. The Ashkukon Kasa Bagavay, and they found what was written in it is the following. And I'll read it in the Hebrew, which is paraphrased by the Korban Asana at the end, because you'll see what he says there. It's basically written in it is as follows. Umatsu Katuba, im isha halazo, if this woman, Tikachle ish halazeh, married this man, Labal, as a husband, Veloy titzi b'chavrutei didei, and she doesn't like him anymore, and she doesn't like his company, and they decide that they're going to get divorced, okay? Kolayma shetehei akva mimena tikach chetzi ktuba. She can take half the ktuba. Meaning they made an agreement, even though halachically this might not be required of the husband to pay, but they agreed in advance in a prenuptial way, and they actually put it into the ktuba in this Yerushalmi, that if whatever reason there is a breakdown in the marriage, then without any questions being asked, she's entitled to at least half the ketubah. And that was considered to be valid because they pre-agreed to do that. So why don't we just insert some kind of prenuptial agreement between the parties so that when everybody is friendly, when everybody loves each other, when everybody wants to get on with each other, they can pre-agree what's going to be in the event that Chas v'Shalom, they in the end want to separate. So the answer is they can, but the question is how are they going to do it? First of all, why don't they just agree in advance that if we get a civil divorce, then you will give me a get? Why doesn't the husband just agree to that? Okay? So that is not going to work. The reason that is not going to work is because this is called a kinyan dvarim. If you look at number two, the Rambam says very interestingly here in Hilchos Mechira that something which is a future agreement but without any transfer of a present existing object, it's not necessarily going to be a binding contract. It's called a kinyan dvarim. In English law, there's a similar thing, an agreement to agree. If you enter into an agreement to agree to something, then the courts are very unhappy about agreements to agree, because what exactly have you agreed to? You've just agreed to do something which is very non-quantifiable. So too says the Rambam, hadvarim she'ein bahem mamash. If you agree to do something which is not specific and physical in this sense, ain't a kinyan moil bahem. It doesn't work. The kinyan doesn't actually take effect. Ketan, how does that work? So he gives an example. Harishikasa v'shva v'kinyan, okay, v'kinu v'pleini, sheyelech v'tchoyre impleini. They agree that we will one day do business with each other. That's an agreement. You'll go into business with me, I'll go into business with you. Or sheyechalku asadish shebeneihim, or one day we'll split the field somehow. We'll split the money up one day. We'll agree how to split the money up. Or shishtat v'shneim ba'umnus, or we'll go into some partnership together. But you don't make any specific details of the partnership. We just agree we'll go into business together. Ukiyotzi b'dvarim eilu kulam, hari hen kinyan dvarim. That is too vague. It is a kinyan dvarim. The ein moil klum. It doesn't do anything. Shehari lo hikna l'chaveru davam esuyam v'yadua. You haven't actually given anything over now. The kinyan doesn't work. loy ikar, not any substance, but loy peirot, or any future specific peirot, any gain from that, how you do, which is known. And therefore, an agreement that one day I will give you a get, signed 30 years earlier, is not considered to be binding in halacha, according to many of the kinyan dvarim. And also, even if it is binding, it may make the get a forced get. Because why is he giving the get now? Because he's forced to do so by an agreement that he made many years earlier. So a pre-agreement that he's going to give her a get is not going to be the solution that they want. So what about a penalty? What if he pre-agrees in advance something very specific, and he says in the Ksubah or in some other week, let's not mess with the Ksubah, let's assume we're going to sign a separate agreement. Why doesn't he say in a separate agreement, if we get divorced, if I don't give you a get, I will give you X amount of money in the event of refusing to give you a get. What is wrong with that? So the answer is, that's a machlok, that's a debate. Have a look, please, on page number 3, on the top of the page. Financial incentives can be acceptable in getting the husband to give a get. The classic case in the poskim is the following scenario. The husband refuses to give the wife a get, and then he ends up, for some other reason, in jail. He's in debtor's prison. They don't put people indebted to prison anymore in most countries, but they certainly used to. So he's languishing in jail because he can't pay off this debt. And the family of the wife come along and say, listen, we'll pay off your debt on condition that you give the get. So all the posts can agree that that's fine, that's acceptable, because that is not him being forced to give a get. They've incentivized him to give the get by saying, look, it's your choice, mate. You can either sit in jail, or you can get out of jail and give the wife a get. That's fine. The question is, what about something which is more of a penalty as opposed to an incentive? So have a look in number 3 here. So the Shulchan Aruch in Aruch Haim says the following. Im nishba habal, if the husband makes a promise in advance, liten get, that he will give a get, like we said before, I promise that I will give you a get at some point. You have to get that release. Because that already says the Shulchan Aruch is no good. The husband can't be bound by a prior agreement that he must give a get. That's called a forced get. That won't work in halacha. Says the Ramah, for who adim im kibel kinyan legarish. If he accepts some kind of agreement, kinyan, that he promises he's going to give a divorce, that won't work either. Aval im kibel alav knasot. But if he agrees to a fine, if he says, I'll pay you a penalty, im lo yigaresh, if he doesn't give her a divorce, loy mikre oynes, that's okay, that works. Give a parallel. What about Tanaim with a wedding? What does it say in Tanaim? In Tanaim it often says that I'm going to marry you and you're going to marry me, and if I don't marry you, I'll pay you a penalty. So, do we say then that the marriage has been forced by the penalty? He's been forced against his will to get married, otherwise he'll have to pay money? We say no. The kiddushin is perfectly fine. Even though he has to get married, otherwise he'll have to pay a lot of money, nothing happens with the kiddushin is fine. So why don't we say the same with kisses? So the first opinion in the Shulchan Aruch is, that's fine, it's not called oynes. He can be required to give a penalty. However, the second opinion says, v'yesh machmirim, there is another opinion, which says no, this is not acceptable. Afil b'kai gavna, which is the Rashba's opinion, that even in this situation, the fact that he might have to pay a penalty is itself something which makes the get forth. Says the Ramah, v'tov l'chush l'chadchila, ideally we should be concerned for this opinion. Ulapatra min haknas, and we should not allow him to be subject to this knas. Aval in kfar girish, if he's already divorced the woman, mitneizeh, because of this knas. V'afilu girish mikor shvua, even if he forced her, having promised to force her, which we said was not right, she'asam atzmo l'garish, haget kosher. But he ever gets kosher. So came along many poskim in the 1940s, 50s and said, look, this is a machlokas. There is a debate in the poskim. If the husband agrees to give a financial penalty if he doesn't give a get, many poskim say that is acceptable. So why not impose on the husband in advance an agreement in a prenup saying, if I don't give you a get, I give you $500,000, whatever it is, $5,000, whatever he agrees to give. We'll see, there's a question of asmachta, we'll get to that in a minute. Why can't we do that? Ah, there's an opinion that says that that's not valid. So the Ramah says, but the Eved, it is valid. The Chatchila, we should be machmir, but the Eved, it works. So is the Aguna situation not a B'di Eved? Meaning, why can't we rely on the situation, but the Eved rely on the minority opinion, or the lenient opinion? So the answer to that is, with Kiddushin, we're much more relaxed than we are with Gittin. The stakes are very high with Gittin. If whatever reason the get doesn't work, or if large parts of the community consider that it doesn't work, you have a very, very serious situation where the remarriage is invalid and the children are considered to be mamzerim, etc., etc., and therefore, even though we may be lenient with kiddushin and say that a penalty if you don't get married doesn't affect the marriage with gittin, most poskim have been very reluctant to cause a bigger problem in order to solve an already big problem. And therefore, this solution, classically, has not been accepted by most of the poskim. There were poskim that didn't like this, that said, sorry, this should have been acceptable, because the evidence is acceptable, but most of the poskim did not accept this. However, in the 1980s, the RCA came up with a different idea. It wasn't truth is their idea. The idea had been floated already from the 70s. I brought you some footnotes here. Why not give an agreement in a prenup? Not that there'll be a specific penalty if I don't give a get, but that we'll pay damages because of the damage that we've caused you. Okay? It's not coercing the get, but it's just imposing damages. Why do we do that? So the 1980s version of the RCA prenup did that. But again, some poskim said the damages themselves could be enough of a penalty that the get is going to be a forced get. So what ended up happening is the RCA prenup that we have today. And that's a very interesting document. If I had the time, I would take you through the prenup and show you how it works. But I'll give you an overview of this. The RCA, the current RCA prenup, which has been very, very strongly pushed by most people within the Rabbinical Council of America world, in the YU world, certainly in the modern Orthodox world, it was developed in the 1990s, largely through the work and encouragement of Rav Willig, Rav Mordechai Willig. He's very much behind it. It has the haskama of many, many of the leading poskim in the YU world, in the modern Orthodox world, but also in the wider Haredi community, including Rav Avadi Yosef, Rav Zalman Chemi Goldberg, Rav Osher Weiss, who's written a long letter giving his support to this. And I brought you some links at the bottom to recent articles which claim that many, many other Haredi Rabbonim have come on board, both in Israel and America, to this RCA prenup. So this is gaining traction, and this is gathering, if you like, steam as something which is being accepted by many, many people. The RCA, I'm an RCA rabbi, so I'm not going to go against the RCA line in any kind of public way. Not that I want to, but I wouldn't do anyway. But the RCA has passed many, many resolutions, including one in 2006 where it says, look here in the middle, since there is a significant aguna problem in America and throughout the Jewish world, the Rabbinical Council of America declares that no rabbi should officiate at a wedding where a proper prenuptial agreement on a get has not been executed. So the RCA basically tells its rabbis, you should not be officiating as a Masada Kedushin unless you check that the people have made a prenup. Now, the RCA has actually just passed another resolution in 2016 that is not yet public, and I'm not yet at liberty to reveal the wording, but it's even stronger than this, insisting that the RCA rabbinate require a prenup when they enter into, when they guide a couple, and therefore this is being very strongly supported, certainly by the RCA and by many other people. You'll see that wording when it comes out. It's not quite insistence, but it's certainly very strong. How does the RCA prenup work? Basically, it does two things. The first thing is an arbitration agreement, a binding arbitration agreement that says that the parties agree, and they sign a separate document, not in the ksuba, they sign a separate document which they keep together with the ksuba, and they say that they will agree that in the event of a dispute, they will go to a specific basin. Now, they don't have to agree on the Bet Din of America, which is the RCA Bet Din. They can agree on any Bet Din, but they have to agree. This solves already one problem, which is something that unfortunately often happens, is that when the parties have a breakdown, the husband runs to a Beis Din which is known to be less scrupulous and is known to be much more supportive of the husband's situation in these scenarios, and therefore ends up dragging everybody along by using a Beis Din that can actually be, if you like, a problem rather than a solution. This arbitration agreement cuts that out, and it's binding. Rav Moshe Feinstein, before he died, gave a tshuva absolutely clearly saying that arbitration agreements, he wasn't talking about the RCA prenup, because that came out after he died, but the arbitration agreements in principle, they work, and they are binding in halacha, and if the parties agree to go to a Beis Din, that is binding. So that will already help to some degree. Then the arbitration agreement can be enforced by the civil courts, because if it's a binding arbitration, the American courts and the British courts, etc., will enforce that as an arbitration, binding on the parties, and that doesn't make the get ma'usa, because it's, again, the classic scenario of the non-Jewish courts simply enforcing a Beis Din ruling, which is fine. 100%, you're absolutely right. They are required. I'm not 100% what the situation is in America, but in the Israeli equivalent of this, which I'll come on to in a minute, they are required to file a copy with the Moatza Datit, with all of the paperwork, which gets put together with the copy of the Ketubah and the Tu'udat Nisuin and all of that stuff. So it's absolutely part of the system and on file. So that's the first thing he does, the arbitration agreement. Yes. If they can't agree on that when they all love each other and they're all happy with each other, then that's the question. Why would they not be able to agree? Meaning, what if they can't agree on which rav to ask Shiloh to? Meaning there are things when they get married they have to work out. So if the prenup becomes something that everybody does, then they'll have to, this is one of the things that they will have to agree. Just like we have to agree whether we're going to your side for Pesach or my side for Pesach, or which hall we're going to get married. Listen, things can blow up, but this is another thing they have to agree on. Yes. 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 Absolutely. They agree on that. And quite frankly, I don't think anyone's going to fall out about which Beis Din they're going to go to before they even get married in the event of a divorce. I don't think that's going to cause a problem. And if it does, that might be an underlying issue which needs to be talked about anyway. The second thing that the RCA prenup does is as follows. It imposes a halachic requirement on the husband after they separate to give mezonot to the wife. Meaning, while they are together, the husband has a halakhic obligation to give mezonot to the wife, unless she waives that. She's entitled to waive that during the marriage. But as we said, after they separate, then it's sometimes difficult to assess whether he still has an obligation, because it depends if he left her, if she left him, like we said. This prenup basically says, this, irrespective of who thinks what happened and who left who, you, the husband, have an obligation to give the wife, if you separate, a mezonot, a fixed penalty, not a penalty, a fixed what's the word, compensation of sustenance of mezonot, of maintenance, of a quantified amount. At the moment, the prenup says $150 per day, index linked, which $150 sounds a lot of money per day, but actually when you actually work out how much it costs to live in 21st century America with school fees and insurance and everything else that needs to go into the pot, $150 per day is by no means a ridiculous amount. If she fails to cooperate in the divorce proceeding, in the Beis Din proceeding, she loses that. So she can't mess him around. Meaning, at the point at which she starts stringing him along and saying, I'm not going to accept again, I'm not coming to the Beis Din, she stops getting her money. So if he's messing her around, it costs him. If she's messing him around, it costs her. Because there's a parallel payment that also she agrees to pay him $150 a day, okay, as part of the process until the process is resolved. That way, because this is not a penalty in order to give the get, it is simply a maintenance payment which they're entitled to give each other. That way, almost everybody will say that this has no problem of rendering the get a get mu'useh. Go over the page, please. Yes. Yes, and as long as they're both obligated to give each other, then it cancels itself out. Meaning, if everybody is cooperating with everybody, then nobody pays anything. Exactly. But once one of the parties gets difficult, and is saying, is messing the Beis Din around, a Beis Din which they've pre-agreed on, so there can be no question about that, then it starts to cost them a significant amount of money, which will clearly incentivize them in the real world that this is not worth it, we'll give the get. Correct, absolutely. The question of asmachta, which we talked about, remember when we talked about gambling? We said that one of the reasons why gambling may halakhically be theft is because the person who is giving over the gambling debt doesn't really believe that they are obligated to give it. They never really thought they were going to lose. No one ever thinks they're going to lose in gambling, and therefore maybe it's asmachta. So people have said, well, maybe when the husband signs this, he never thought he was ever going to really have to give this. So maybe that's a question of asmachta, which will make it invalid. So they put various different wordings into the agreement, which will deal with the issue of asmachta. It has certain wordings. It's me'achshav. It's with a bet din chashuv. Meaning they've thought of that and they've put that in so that you can't claim that it's asmachta and he never really meant it. You can also sign it as a postnup, not only a prenup. In fact, as far as I'm aware, when Rav Willig was pushing this and encouraging young couples to sign this, he himself signed a postnup agreement with his wife in order to encourage other people to do the same thing, as far as I'm aware. You can do this as a postnup. In fact, halakhically, it may even be preferable to do this as a postnup, because then the husband is waiving rights or giving rights that he already has accrued as a husband because the marriage exists, as opposed to before the marriage, when the marriage does not yet exist, it may be less clear. The reason we usually do it as a prenup is because of English law and American law, that it works better that way because there's consideration. I'm not getting into all of that. We can talk about the legal effects later. People in the RCA say that the RCA prenup have an almost 100% success rate. There are organizations in America which are helping Agunot, which are assisting in dealing with this, and they are very encouraging of using this, and they say it really does help. It really does do the trick halakhically, and also incentivizes the husband, or in some cases the wife, but usually the husband, to give the get where necessary. So why doesn't everybody use it? Why doesn't this solve the problem? Why do we still have an aguna problem if this is halakhically fine, and there's no reason why people should not institute it? So I've written down 5 reasons, and some of them are more serious than others, but they're all relevant. One reason why this has not yet caught on is because anything new is rightly regarded with some level of suspicion. Meaning we have to have some concern for the integrity of the halakhic process. We don't just run headlong into a new innovation in halakha without thinking very, very carefully about whether it's going to cause other effects which are negative, how it's going to affect the halakhic process as a whole, and obviously senior people have to give that a lot of concern. This is going to be a balance between, on the one hand, the level of innovation that we think it is halakhically, and on the other hand, the need for it in the community. Now, the people who support this agreement clearly feel that this is low-level innovation, high-level need, and therefore, what's the problem? Other people are still thinking about that, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think we should be rushing into solutions until we've really thought about them. Yes? We'll come to Israel right now, but first of all, the United States. In Israel, it's less used than in the United States, but we'll see the Rabbanei Sohar have got their own version of this. Some people, and I think this is a much less valid argument, some people say it is inappropriate to discuss such matters before they get married. It is inconsistent with the romantic nature of the marriage. You know, the lead up to the marriage, they're going to start getting involved lawyers and talking about financial penalties, etc., etc. This is not appropriate for the couple before they get married. Some people make that argument. I have difficulty really understanding that argument because everybody signs a ksuba. The ksuba deals with all sorts of unpalatable eventualities, the death of the husband, the divorce of the couple. Nobody has a problem signing the ksuba. Why? Because nobody really reads the ksuba. Okay. So, fine. So it's accepted that, well, having said that, that many rabbanim are insistent that they read the ksuba at the wedding to the husband, and that's a good thing. But everybody signs the ksuba because everybody signs the ksuba. They even have it painted and put on the wall. Okay? So, let everybody, don't worry about the prenup. Let them have that painted and put on the wall as well. Meaning, if you can put your ksuba on the wall, you can have a beautiful prenup, a calligraphy prenup, and you can have that on the wall as well. I mean, who knows? Maybe that'll happen too. Okay? But the issue of romance, I think, is a red herring. I mean, really, people can do these things. There's so many technical, unromantic things that have to be gone through in order to plan a wedding. This can just be another one of those. So I'm not 100% sure where that's coming from. Of course, there is hashgraphic politics, of course, that goes on, that anything which this group supports, this group feels that they have to oppose. That's just the way it is, and we have to do whatever we can to make people understand that people's happiness and lives are at stake here, and this is not something that they can be really impose a communal politics on, because it's really not acceptable, but that is an issue. More seriously, and this has to be said because it's important, I've heard many shurim on this issue of the prenup, and I don't know if they all state both sides. There are people who are still very unhappy with the RCA prenup. Rav Moshe Sternbuch, who is an important halakhic figure in Israel, who was until recently the head of the Eidah Haredis, he is very firmly against it. He said he considers it to be a get ma'useh. The get is a forced get if it's done on the back of an RCA prenup. He said even if the penalty is not formally linked with the get, he thinks the husband never really intended to sign it, to give this money. He feels that this encourages divorce, where maybe marriages could be saved, meaning that now there's a mechanism for them to get divorced. This is a difficult argument to really have, because to what extent do we want to maintain marriages which clearly have irretrievably broken down? this idea of not encouraging divorce is a clearly a correct one. We are not in favor of divorce at will. But there are marriages that clearly have ended, and they need to be brought to an end, and it is a mitzvah to bring them to an end. And therefore, there is definitely a discussion to be had here, but it must be said that some senior poskim of this nature were very much against it and are very much against it. Rav Eliashib was very much against the old RCA prenup. We don't know what he would say about the new RCA prenup. Maybe he would think differently, but maybe he would not. And perhaps more importantly for the YU world, Rav J. David Bleich is also not happy with the RCA prenup. And that is a big issue, because he is a very big voice in the world of centrist orthodoxy, and if you want to know his specific issues, I've given you a reference there to a 110-page analysis of one of Rabbi Black's students, which you can download free, and you can go through all 110 pages. I did, and it says it was written with the careful mentoring of Rabbi Black, and you can see there the issues that he has. He wants to make certain changes. Rabbi Black has written many, many articles on this issue, and he's obviously a world Talmid Chacham on these questions, and therefore his view definitely has to be taken seriously. Yes. One second, is this the lady over there? Sorry. Right. No, I wasn't implying anything. I think it would be naive to say that Hashkafa politics is not present. Of course it is. One of my Rosh Yeshiva, once in one of his tongue-in-cheek moments, I shan't say who or when, but asked the question, why does the Yeshivish or Haredi world not plant trees on Tu Bishvat? Meaning it's beautiful to plant trees in Tu Bishvat. It's maybe even a mitzvah. There's an Orach Chaim about how it's a mitzvah, it's Israel, etc. He says, look, one of the reasons is they can't do it because the other guys plant trees on Tu Bishvat, and therefore they can't please them. So he said, it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, and he said, Baruch Hashem, the other guys don't sit and learn Gemara all day, otherwise what would we do all day? So, you know, a tongue-in-cheek moment. But the Hashkafic politics, it's funny, but it's not funny, because it has a real cause. But my segue into the last 2 points was not at all linked with the politics. There are real halachic issues here, which major people have raised, and therefore they have to be taken seriously. In Israel, there is an equivalent of the prenup, of the RCA prenup, which is the Tzohar prenup, which actually my daughter and my son-in-law signed. I hope I'm not giving away any family secrets by saying that. The Tzohar prenup is very, very similar to the RCA prenup. It is very much encouraged by the Rabbanit Tzohar, and the Rabbanut itself is, I wouldn't say it pushes it, but it's certainly open to it. Although there is in Israel still a lot of reluctance and suspicion of doing things like that. Of course, a lot of people in Israel, even in the Dati Lumi community, are very, very traditional and very conservative when it comes to change of this nature. And therefore, the Rabbanei Tzohar prenup, I don't think, has caught on in the same way in the religious Zionist community that the RCA prenup has caught on to some degree in the modern Orthodox community. But we'll see where that goes, and we'll see how that changes. But it's there, and I brought you the links. It can be downloaded. They have a nice page in English. They have a nice page in Hebrew. It's got a couple holding hands with lots of harps and violins on the front of it. So, you know, it's trying to make it as user-friendly as it possibly can be, and that's certainly one of the options. So the RCA stroke Rabbanei Tzohar prenup. Yes, sir? In the UK, there is a London Beit Din ruling on this. I'm not that familiar with it. I think there are prenups in the UK. Jerry, do you remember what people do? I don't remember ever personally having spoke to anyone that ever signed one in the UK. Okay? But that's a good question. We need to do a bit of homework. What happens in the UK? The UK sometimes comes along a few years later on these issues.
They have laws about existing countries, like in the war, how long does it wait?
No, that's a different issue. That's the classic Aguna issue of a missing husband. That has to be dealt with in the classic way, like we saw with the 9/11, with evidence that's brought from different parties as far as we can to be relaxed, lenient, but the stakes, as we said, are high. We talked about that last week. That used to be the practice, even until the Second World War, that the husband would give a get al tanai, but that is no longer the practice, as far as I'm aware, in the IDF. They do not encourage the soldiers to do that, even when they're going into war situations. And I'm not entirely sure of the thinking process in the IDF as to how the effectiveness versus the impact on morale, etc. That's something that needs to be thought through. Yes. I can't hear you, sorry. To sign a prenuptial agreement. And does the London Beit Din have their own form of prenuptial agreement? Okay, so there's your answer. There is an active encouragement to sign a prenup in London as well. I've just been a little bit out of London for too long to be totally up to speed with what's going on there. So I think it's happening in many different places, and we'll see which direction it goes. Enforce it, absolutely. Rav Gorin, 100%. It didn't work, it didn't happen. Like many things that didn't happen when Rav Gorin became the chief rabbi in the way that he hoped they would happen. Fine, let's talk about some other solutions which didn't gain any traction for different reasons, and then we'll bring it to a close. Turn to page 5, please. There are a number of solutions which have been rejected very, very clearly by the Orthodox world, but which were pushed by different groups. One of them is Hafka'at Kiddushin. Can we turn round and say that because all Kiddushin is made on the understanding that it's made Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, meaning the Rabbanim, if you like, have to be part of the Kiddushin process, if not directly, then by implication, so they, just as they're there to make the Kiddushin, they can unmake the Kiddushin as well, and they can declare that the Kiddushin is retroactively invalid. Have a look, please, number 4. The Gemara in Gittin suggests this. In fact, it brings this as an option. Mi ikamidi. Is there a situation, says the Gemara, the Midah Oraita Batel Gitta, that on a Torah level the get is not valid, and the marriage is still in theory there? Umishuma Kayach Basin Yafa, because of the issue of the Koach of the Basin, Sharinan Eshid Ish La Alma. They can still allow the woman who was married, they can release her from the marriage, even though the get is not a valid get. Is this possible? And the Gemara answers, in. Yes, it is. And it gives this a formula, called the Mekadesh, anyone who engages in Kiddushin and marries, Adaita Derabonon Mekadesh. They do this on the understanding it is with the implicit support of the rabbis and on the understanding of the rabbinic process. So too, says the Gemara there, V'akin Rabonon Kiddushin Minei. If the rabbis can make the Kiddushin, the rabbis can unmake the Kiddushin. So retroactively they can say, this marriage never happened. Amalei Ravina le Ravashi. So Ravina says to Ravashi, Tinech the Kiddush v'kaspa. The Kaddish v'kaspa. Okay, if they did Kiddushin by money, like we do today, they give a ring, whatever. And that's how they made the Kiddushin. Aval Kaddish v'bia. But if they actually already had relations, they already had marital relations. Ma'ik l'neima. Are you going to undo the Kiddushin? When it's all now a done deal and they've even been maritally together for many years perhaps? Says the Gemara, yes, Shavin and Rabbanan Labalitu Be'ilat Znut. Okay? So they can retroactively, even in a case where the couple have been together, they can allow the marriage to be unpicked retroactively, even though that means that every marital relation they have, every sexual relation they had retroactively was actually an extramarital relationship. Even though the stakes are very high in that sense, in order to deal with a marriage that needs to be unpicked, they were prepared to do that. And therefore, there have been many people that have suggested that why can't this be an answer? In the most intractable cases where a get is simply not happening, why can't the rabbis intervene and say, okay, in this situation, we're going to unpick the Kiddushin, and it's not going to be valid anymore. So the children are born out of wedlock, but that does not make them mamzerim. That does not make them mamzerim. It makes them born out of wedlock, which doesn't really have any ongoing stigma. Obviously, it's not an ideal situation, but we're not dealing with an ideal situation. Yes? So, fine. So, the Gemara goes through this, and one of the reasons that this is an unacceptable solution according to most people. I'll tell you who has written very extensively on trying to promote this is Rav Shlomo Riskin. And I brought you the link there to his article that he has very strongly called that in certain cases Hafka'at Kiddushin should be acceptable. Most of the Orthodox rabbinate has rejected it. And one of the reasons are that there are very limited circumstances in which this can happen. And they're brought down by the poskim, and it's not so clear that we can just extend them to other situations where we feel that there needs to be an unraveling of the marriage. According to some poskim, it only works anyway if there's some kind of a get and not on its own. And therefore, most people, in fact, almost all Orthodox Poskim have rejected Haftarat Kiddushin as a valid option, but it's important to say that Rav Riskin, who is an important figure and is an important thinker and is a very vocal advocate of this, he's written a whole book on it and he's written many articles on it, and you should read what he's written on this and understand why he takes that view. Okay? The second rejected solution that I've mentioned here is Kiddushei Ta'ut. This is very interesting. This Kiddushei Tos, this is a kind of parallel to a Mekach Tos. What's a Mekach Tos? A Mekach Tos is where two parties transact something, and it turns out that what in fact they get is very different from what they thought they were getting. Obviously, brides and husbands laugh in the sense that, like, isn't all marriage like that on some level? Yes, I understood that. But let's just take the case of, obviously not the same as a marriage, but let's take the case of buying a washing machine, okay? Marriage is not parallel to buying a washing machine, it must be clear. But if I transact with a shop to sell me a washing machine, and then they deliver me a dishwasher, so I don't owe anyone anything. I just call them up and say, take this junk away, this is not what I wanted, this is completely mekartos, and I'm not bound in any way. I don't have to go to court to try and work out, forget it, just take it back, I don't want it. So too, can you turn around and say that if the wife marries a husband and it turns out that he is mamash, not at all what she thought she was marrying, can she turn around and say the kiddushin is invalid? It's a mekach tov, I thought I was getting this husband, I in fact was getting this husband, is that valid or not? So the it is important to say that there were certain grounds on which this was considered to, yes, be valid. Obviously, let's take an extreme case where a bride stands under the chuppah and it turns out the next day that it was the twin brother, the identical twin brother of the guy she thought she was marrying, and she ended up marrying the twin brother. Clearly, she's not married. She doesn't need a get. She's not married. They didn't marry the people who they thought they were marrying. That's not halakhically controversial. Rav Moshe Feinstein, however, did extend this principle a little bit to other cases where there was a fundamental factor at the time of the marriage, which was unknown, it only became known after the marriage, and it is absolutely central to the marital bond. And without it, the marriage is just not a marriage. For example, that the husband was mentally incapable, and there was just no way of knowing that before, but that was pre-existing, and it came up afterwards. Or that the husband was impotent on some level, that is fundamental to the existence of a Jewish marriage, is the ability for the couple to have a sexual relationship. Under very specific circumstances, Rav Moshe was prepared to accept it. However, very famously, there were an attempt to extend this, specifically Rav Emanuel Rachman. Rav Rachman in the 1970s and 80s felt that this should be extended beyond the classic fundamental ta'ut, if you like, of the husband being totally incapable of being a husband, to other scenarios where, I don't know, other defects that came out. The husband was violent and they didn't know he was violent. Or even things that changed after the marriage that weren't a problem when the marriage began that became a problem over the years during the marriage. And pretty much all the Orthodox world said that this was not an acceptable use of the concept of Kiddushei Tos. This was not a new idea. This had already been suggested earlier. And I brought you on the top of page 6, just to finish off with the last few pieces, I brought you a piece by Rav Soloveitchik, a very famous speech that he gave to the RCA many years ago, where he rejects this. I'll leave you to read this on your own. He stood up very, very strongly and said this was completely unacceptable. You're basically driving a coach and horses through the whole of Gittin by adopting this principle. There will be no classic Torah law at all if you allow this to happen. And you can read Rav Soloveitchik's comments, and therefore that was a rejected approach. And Rav Rachman's Beit Din was active for many, many, many years. Of course, Rav Rachman passed away some years ago. And it released many, many agunot in a way that pretty much everybody in the Orthodox world considered to be unacceptable, which obviously is itself a major problem. I brought you five other suggested approaches which have been rejected. I'll mention them very briefly. The issue of a get zikui, can the Beit Din give a get on behalf of the husband? Can the Beit Din step into the husband's role? And the answer, some have suggested, why can't they do that? And the answer to that is really, zakinita adam shaloi b'fanav, but you can't give someone a detriment. You can't be mechayev somebody shaloi b'fanav without his permission, and therefore a get is a significant negative in many ways for the husband. Therefore, he has to be there to agree to give it. It can't be given by the get Beit Din. What about kiddushin al tanai? Why can't they enter into a declaration when they get married, saying I brought you the wording here in the middle of F4. Behold, you are wedded to me. However, if the judges of the state will divorce us, and I don't give you a Jewish divorce, this marriage is retroactively invalid. He agrees that there is a Tanai. You're missing a page? Oh, you don't have six. Sorry, I apologize. Never mind. You know something? Anyone who really wants page six can email me and I can send them page six, okay? I'm very happy to do that. Or they can actually, you know something better than me? Email the OU Israel Center and they can give you page six because they've got page six as well. They'll be able to do that for you. That doesn't work either. Other things that didn't work, I just mentioned in passing the Lieberman clause. Rabbi Shaul Lieberman wanted to put a clause in the ksuba. You have page seven?
Yes.
Baruch Hashem. So look at page seven for just a minute. Rabbi Shaul Lieberman wanted to put a clause into the ksuba, actually, saying that the parties recognize the authority, in his case, of the JTS, and that they'll do whatever the Beit Din says in order to bring the marriage to an end. This was rejected not only because, obviously, JTS is not an acceptable authority in the Orthodox world, but also because it was rejected as an asmachta. People felt this was not specific enough to be binding, although obviously Rabbi Lieberman, who was a major, major Talmid Chacham, he obviously did feel it was, and that's another debate to have. Finally, I'll just mention that the Reform Movement, already 150 years ago, turned around and said, look, Sidah de Malchus Sedina, why don't you just say that if the civil law of the land says you're divorced, Sidah de Malchus Sedina, that's good enough for us. Just like we say that the law of the land is you can drive at 30 miles an hour, and if you break that, then that's halacha as well. Why don't we say that if the law of the land says you're divorced, then you're divorced? So that clearly doesn't work in halacha. I brought you in number 7, a piece in Shulchan Aruch, which says that Dina de Malchus Adina basically applies to certain civil laws. It'll apply to tax, it'll apply to maybe laws to keep the country working, traffic laws, etc. You can't just drive down the wrong side of the road because you feel that's the halakhic way to do it, although sometimes when you look around you wonder whether people do that. However, Dina de Malchus Adina does not impact on ritual laws. It doesn't impact, if the law of the land bans shechita, that doesn't mean that meat is now not allowed to be shechted. If the law of the land bans Brit Mila, that doesn't mean that Brit Mila is now prohibited, clearly. And therefore, if the law of the land says that you're divorced, that does not mean halakhically you're divorced. That is very clear in halacha. But that was the solution the Reform Movement adopted 150 years ago. Yes, sir? Yes, it also works the other way around as well. And in fact, it is a little bit easier in halacha to make it work the other way around, because there are underlying assumptions in halacha that the wife would prefer to be married, even in situations where the husband would not. And the question is whether that still applies and how that applies in the 21st century in a way which it applied maybe in other years. So that's all I want to say on it. Hopefully that was a helpful overview, especially of the RCA prenup, which is really what I was focusing on. Next week we're going to move away from marriage. I think we have to put marriage behind us, and certainly divorce behind us. I want to move next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, to look at some classic scenarios in which halacha does or doesn't change given social change in society, and when it does and when it doesn't, and how that works. Some very interesting scenarios which are nothing to do with marriage and divorce, but please God, will be interesting. Have a wonderful week.